From Studio J, 10 stories above K Street, this is the Education Gadfly Show.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host back from the AERA conference, Rick Hess.
Hey, I'm here.
So, Rick, I ran into one of our listeners out there in Chicago. I was at the American Education Research Association conference myself for
one day. You did your fly-in and fly-out.
I did. And one of our listeners came to my panel, which was very nice. And he mentioned that he tried to go to your panel session, and you didn't show up for it. Now, Rick, what happened? You were there for 3 days?
There was a spot. I did not know I was on a panel.
But was that due to you drinking heavily throughout?
No, I was just – it was one of those unfortunate points of confusion. I guess I was supposed to do a roundtable, but nobody ever actually let me know that they had signed me up to do this.
Yeah.
And I found out the next day that other people had attended my roundtable absent me. But I got – now, in recent days, you have – debated Joel Packer of the NEA.
That's right.
And former Governor Roy Barnes.
That's correct.
Which of them, how did you stack up? Which of them gave you a better bit of sparring for your money?
I think the governor did a little better sparring, partly because, you know, poor Joel has to just represent the party line of the NEA. So he's not really, you know, doesn't have the free rein to be as creative in his arguments.
But what were you debating with Joel?
Oh, we were talking about standards and testing, accountability, no child left behind, you know.
Good stuff.
But with the governor, we were talking about the No Child Left Behind Commission's reports. He chaired that commission. And, you know, largely we were talking about whether or not we should trust the federal government, you know, to expand its powers in education. You know, he wants to give the same authority to the people who messed up the highly qualified teacher provision. He now wants them to do even more and now enforce something called highly qualified and effective teachers. I'm a little skeptical that they're going to have the ability to do that well.
So, but he pushed back hard when you tried to get him on that?
He pushed back. He did. But he did agree with me that if we had national standards and tests, we could give the states a lot more flexibility over everything else.
Did he leave you a whimpering little puppy on the floor?
No, not at all. I think we had good give and take.
Yeah. All right.
But of course, you know, he is a politician. It was hard to keep up with him. But I had a couple of jokes up my sleeve.
There you go.
But he had some good mama stories that I just couldn't.
About your mama?
No, his mama.
He was calling out your mama?
His mama.
The governor?
His mama.
He was like, Mike, your mama?
No, his mama.
He was like, Mike, his mama? Okay.
All right, listeners, if you have your mama joke that you'd like to send us, send it to letters@excellence.net. We really would love to hear from you, and we don't get as much mail as we would like. So please do send that in. Okay, we're going to get started with the game of Pardon the Gadfly. And we've got an interview with Jonas Chartok down in Texas to talk about a charter school bill making its way through the legislature. And then Liam will impart some education news of the weird. So let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
All right. Topic one. Rick, Vallis is leaving Philadelphia and the great superintendent chase is on once again. Why do we have such a hard time finding and keeping good soups? Is there anything we can do about it?
Woof, woof, that's a lot of activity. Yeah, Paul Vallis has been in Philly, 4 or 5 years now, I guess, after a similar turn in Chicago. One thing is 4 or 5 years is not a ridiculous length of stay for leader of a large, you know, billion-dollar-plus firm. You do see that kind of turnover. Two considerations here, though. One is he's leaving. You don't have a clear deputy hierarchy place in most of these districts, so you don't build on what you've done. Instead, you kind of run a whole new search from scratch, kind of like post-Paysant in Boston. And the second thing is for a lot of these really neat guys, the new breed of superintendents, the Kleins, the Bursons, the Vallises, this is something they do. They step in too late in their career, and then they step back out. So there's no expectation that they're coming in with maybe staying 10 or 20 years, like Jack Welch to GE, or that they are necessarily going to stay in the business. And partly that points to the lack of a real career trajectory in educational leadership at those levels.
You know, it's almost like a political phenomenon where, you know, somebody gets, you know, elected and they serve for a while and they've got their own people and then maybe they lose an election and they and their whole team leaves, right? And so Vallis is going to leave and you wonder if his whole top staff will leave and somebody else will come in with a new vision and – you know, instead, as you say, the more business model where you might grow leadership talent from the ground up. And it, you know, if you have a new CEO, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to totally redo your strategy.
You know, And partly this is about being, you know, enmeshed in kind of the political environment of Philadelphia or Pennsylvania, is if, right, if the Philly schools were an independent operation that were run by self-interested shareholders, say, you could imagine a different set of pressures at work. You know, there's a lot of people who are ticked off at Vallis about various things, and that's going to make it difficult for his deputies to stay and run the shop.
Okay, Jen, next topic.
All right. The Archdiocese of Boston is getting serious about competing with charters. It's even threatened to stop selling diocese-owned property to charter school providers. Is this a sign of a healthy educational marketplace or a Catholic Church forgetting its social justice mission?
Well, you know, I'm disappointed about this, I'll say. You've got some excellent charter schools in Boston, for example, that were planning on expanding, and they had expectations to get some of the facilities from the Archdiocese. And the Archdiocese has decided that, no, we're not going to sell you those buildings after all because we're worried that you're taking too many of our own students to your schools. Now, sure, you could say that's just good old competition, but, you know, a lot of these kids, let's assume that some of these are poor Hispanic students whose families might be members of the Archdiocese themselves. You know, it seems like if the concern is primarily for students, you certainly don't want to do anything that harms good schools that are providing a good education to your flock.
I mean, I'm not even sure it's healthy competition. I mean, this is unhealthy competition. This is the same stuff that we bewail when school districts do it. When they take advantage of, you know, entrenched assets and, you know, market position to try to stifle new competitors rather than outcompete them. It'd be a different story if the Archdiocese in Boston were using these buildings to launch a dynamic and more effective educational program. This is old-fashioned protectionism.
Now, I think they will say that they are going to put schools in those buildings, and they're trying to raise a lot of money to try to rejuvenate the Catholic schools in Boston, which is great and definitely needed. The president this week made a speech at the prayer breakfast. He mentioned the dire straits of Catholic schools and the need to do something about
it. What's the prayer breakfast?
You know, the national prayer breakfast.
There's a national prayer breakfast?
Yeah.
Is this like an annual
thing? This is an annual thing.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
I guess you haven't been invited that round.
How did you know about it?
I read the newspaper.
Oh. Well, good for him and good for them.
Pray tell. Okay.
It's once again, they leave the, you know, here's the Jewish boy on the outs. They don't connect us.
The rabbis come.
The rabbis come?
They do.
They didn't tell me about it.
Yeah.
The rabbis are got me on the outs.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
All right. Rick, a new book says Cuba's education system is pretty good. Is there anything we can learn from an authoritarian socialist country about improving our own schools?
I haven't seen this book, Mike. Well, what book is this?
You know, I've seen a review of this book, and I think it's an edited volume. There were some scholars. I believe Linda Darling-Hammond was one of them, you know, who wrote about some of the successes of the Cuban education system, what we can learn from it.
You know, as much as I would love to kind of poke fun at the idea of Linda, you know, writing adoringly about Castroite ed reform, I got to say, when all I know is that you have seen somebody's unpublished review of a book and we apparently have it nowhere around, it leaves me feeling very unsure about saying a darn thing about the text.
Are you questioning my credibility?
I'm questioning, the credibility of the unpublished review, which is the only link we have to the actual text.
Yes. I mean, you know, but my understanding is that the book, you know, says in glowing terms that the Cuba system is working well in part because there's fantastic teachers and who teach in a fairly traditional way but have high level of training and expertise. Now, of course, those teachers have no choice about whether or not they want to teach in the Cuban education system. And probably not a lot of opportunities in the free market.
Well, I mean, I'm curious what kind of outcome data we have on the quality of Cuban schools. I wonder if this is graduation rates or – I mean, I wonder by what metric these folks have determined that Cuban schools were effective. If that's actually what this Phantom Book is about.
Not, right.
You know, or we could just all read Jonathan Kozol's next read, which is more or less about the, you know, joys of Cuban education.
Right.
Whether he writes about Newark or Patterson.
Right. What if one outcome indicator is, you know, how many of these Cuban graduates, you know, make the trip, you know, across to Miami via lifeboat? You know, I don't know. Is that a positive thing or a negative thing?
Actually, that'd be a good Kozol title. You know, from Havana to what's a good American kind of, you know,
Houston?
Down on its luck city? Yeah, I guess Houston. If I was thinking something more like something really down on its luck.
Detroit.
No, with an H. It's got to start with an H. Anyway.
Think about that one. Okay.
From Atlanta to Houston. That's not bad.
Speaking of Houston and Texas, next up we have an interview with Jonas Schartuck from the Texas Public Charter School something. Let's have the interview.
The Charter School Policy Institute, big guy.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you. Let's hear it. Joining us today in the show is Jonas Schartuck, the CEO of the Charter School Policy Institute down in Texas. Jonas, welcome to the Education Gadfly Show.
Great to be with you, Mike.
So, Jonas, understand that a bill just cleared the Senate down in Texas that would try to kill some of the worst charter schools in Texas while improving funding for the better charter schools. Tell us just a little bit about how that program would work.
Sure. Well, the basic approach was that, you know, the Senate, specifically Senator Shapiro, wanted, who's the chair of the Education Committee in the Senate, was interested in figuring out a way to shut down schools that were underperforming by a certain standard, and we can get into that in a second, and also figure out a way to start introducing some facilities funding to schools that are deemed as high-performing. So the details of kind of where it gets interesting in terms of how they define, you know, what quality looks like and kind of the procedures that they use to define who gets the money and who gets shut down.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the politics, you know, because from my point of view, this is very promising. We've certainly talked about how in Ohio, just last week, we had Checker on talking about how the governor in Ohio wants to basically kill all the charter schools. And, you know, we'd much prefer something that helped good schools but did get rid of the really bad ones. Now, aren't the bad charter schools fighting like heck to get their representatives to stop this from happening?
Well, I would get into first defining what bad is. Because I think that it's tough for me to sort of, like, you know, immediately accept, or, you know, for I think a lot of the public to immediately accept what bad looks like.
Okay.
Until we kind of agree on what the measurement is.
Okay. So real quickly, what's the definition of bad in this case?
Well, in terms of what's bad in terms of the way the Senate is approaching it, is 25% or fewer of your student body need to pass the reading and math test. So, and that's across the board, no matter what kind of charter school you run.
Okay.
So, pardon me. So, you know, so right off the bat, we're sort of assuming, and we don't agree or disagree at this point that this is right or wrong, but the idea that, you know, a snapshot of test scores basically determines whether you're a good or bad school.
Okay. So, and it's not looking at growth over time, for example.
That's correct. There's no measure of growth at all.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. So, but tell us some about the politics of this, though. So,
sure. So basically, the approach is that there is a sentiment in the state that there are some schools that are getting away with things, as we know, getting away with things financially that are inappropriate, and there are not swift measures to shut those schools down. So the intent was to figure out a way to do that very quickly on the financial side. Now, on the academic side, you know, same situation where, you know, we see some schools that have a 1% passing rate in math or reading. So the desire amongst a number of the legislators is to figure out a way to eliminate those schools.
Okay. Now, how did the teacher unions, I know, of course, in Texas it's a right-to-work state, but still the teacher associations always say, what is their position on this? Seems like they would support getting rid of these bad charter schools.
Absolutely, they would support that. And again, it is a state where there's not a ton of attention on the part of unions toward charter schools, so they're not extremely active in this area right now.
Okay, so then is this thing going to go through? Is anybody kind of trying to fight this proposal, especially the increased funding for the good charters?
No, in fact, I've been interested to see the fact that, you know, most of the schools, even those schools that are sort of on the chopping block right now, they're not so much focused at all on fighting the fact that some schools would be getting facilities funding. I think it's attractive to almost everybody within the charter movement that anybody in Texas would get facilities money at this point. So I think that everybody, generally speaking, for what I can tell, is in support of that measure. The only thing is that, you know, there will definitely be a fight from those schools, especially what we would call dropout recovery schools or risk and recovery schools, who are the predominantly are those schools that would likely be shut down.
Okay. Well, this is interesting. I mean, one lesson then for charter school advocates might be that if you're trying to get charter school funding increased or facilities funding, you might attach a provision that also at the same time cleans house on some of the low-performing charters and vice versa. It's an interesting package. Well, good. Well, Jonas, thanks for joining us. Before we leave, just how much longer until this bill will either succeed or fail down there before the session ends?
Well, I can tell you no matter what, it'll be done by May 31st.
Okay. Well, good. Well, we will be watching the news, and interesting to see what happens. Jonas, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Mike.
So what do you think, Rick? Should every state have a law like this, kind of clean house the bad charters and give more funding to the good ones?
Well, it's not entirely clear what this law is going to actually say. I mean, I think Jonas pointed out that there seems to be a lot of moving parts to it. Yeah, I mean, anything we can do to make it easier to flush out ineffective and mediocre charter schools is all to the good, and especially if we can redirect those resources to support and expand in good schools. But I got to say, I mean, I think Jonas himself sounded a little equivocal on how effectively this law is actually going to manage to do that.
Yeah, I mean, the big question is, what do you do with some of these schools that are especially dropout recovery schools going after kids who have already failed out of the public education system? And, you know, what are the fair expectations for the results those schools can attain?
Yeah, I mean, this is particularly the insanity with level-based metrics.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it's
by which we mean, Mr. Wonk, that, you know, by just looking at one test score in time instead of how students grow over the course of the year.
Right. Where your kids wind up rather than how much you move them along. And this is kind of the devil's bargain that the choice advocates got into when all these times when they've used just end of the year data to, you know, score points against public school systems serving poor and disadvantaged kids. You know, it was always a somewhat unfair critique of those systems because it doesn't actually say whether those schools are doing a good job or not.
Right.
And unfortunately, they're now dealing with the same stuff.
All righty. Well, it is now time for everyone's favorite education news of the weird with our special and specially weird correspondent, Liam Julian. Hola, Liam. What is weird this week?
Cuba would be a hot spring break destination if it weren't against the law for Americans to go there. But that didn't stop the administration of New York City's Beacon School, a public school in the Upper West Side, from making the trip anyway. Despite receiving a firm no from New York City's Department of Education, the school allowed students, one teacher, and two parents to visit Cuba during spring break for an educational trip, on which they interviewed a 15-year-old prostitute and hung out in jazz clubs. Former New York City Councilwoman Eva Moskowitz told the New York Times, quote, "I can't imagine why this is a bad thing," unquote. Mayor Mike Bloomberg and school's Chancellor Joel Klein, who have asked for an investigation of the incident, seemed to answer Moskowitz when they pointed out at a press conference that the trip was against the law. Rick, what's your favorite part of The Godfather 2?
Oh, you know, when he's talking to Frankie Five Angels about how the Roman consuls used to commit suicide in order to protect their families. I brought tears to my eyes.
I don't get that reference at all. What does that have to do with Cuba?
A large portion of The Godfather 2 takes place in Cuba, Havana, during the expropriation.
Okay.
Was Eva being
Have you seen the movie?
I only saw the first Godfather.
You're always talking about your Italian heritage.
I know. But I figure they can never improve upon the first Godfather.
No, actually, most critics suggest that Godfather 2 is better than the original, and it's one of the, you know, probably the most highly acclaimed sequel in movie history.
Rick, do you think that people are going to think that we're anti-Castro on this show? We've really been beating up on Cuba this week.
I don't know. What the heck? Maybe we're anti-everybody else.
You know, there's that really reactionary radio station down in Miami, Radio Mambi, that's just for hours a day rails against Castro.
Yeah.
Maybe we could send them a link to the podcast.
That's a good idea. I'm sorry, Rick. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, do you think Eva was being tongue-in-cheek when she was talking to the Times?
Eva Moskowitz, that is. Moskowitz, as Liam said.
But I'm curious. I wonder if she was being tongue-in-cheek with the reporter and they ran it straight.
I don't know, because it's hard to believe that Eva's, she thought this was a
that doesn't
great
sound like
idea.
Yeah, who knows? That's one of those things.
Yeah, well, it's good, you know, and as we see more and more of these small schools in New York and other places that are these, you know, socialist schools and other things, I imagine this sort of thing is going to keep happening.
It's Yeah. I don't know about that.
And then, you know, what?
You know, the theme schools, they're going to call the theme school, you know, it's going to be the magnet school for introduction to 15-year-old prostitutes.
Well, and did they have to go to Cuba to interview a prostitute? I mean, there are no prostitutes in New York City? I want to know about that. All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this week. Thank you for joining us. Don't forget to read the original Education Gadfly, which is a great one this week, I'm telling you, at edexcellence.net. Till next week,
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.